The Technion Israel Institute of Technology is where some of Israel's brightest minds ask the biggest question of all. What if? What if they could take on the world's biggest challenges? What if they could develop life-changing environmental, scientific, health, medical, and technological discoveries that will make a huge impact on Israel and the planet? But they don't just ask the question, they answer it too. They turn those ideas into reality. They make them happen. To see just some of the incredible things they've achieved, get the Technion Booklet of Wonders at ats.org/wonders. We hope it inspires you to give them your support so they can keep doing what they do best. The American Technion Society. World-changing discoveries by Israel's brightest minds, made possible by you.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Times Will Tell, the weekly podcast from the Times of Israel. I am Amanda Borshel-Dan. This week, we're traveling to Europe, at least virtually, and speaking with two impressive individuals. First, I have a short chat with 29-year-old Swedish composer Jacob Morand, who just ahead of the January 27th International Holocaust Remembrance Day is releasing his a cappella choir piece, Kaddish, on the prestigious Deutsche Grammophon label. He was inspired by his Holocaust survivor grandfather, and the piece is frankly spellbinding. Stick around until the end of the program when we'll play the piece in full. Next, I speak with Brussels-based Katharina von Schneumann, who is the first European Commission coordinator on combating anti-Semitism. We speak about the IRA working definition of anti-Semitism and about some of its practical and problematic results. But first, let's hear the opening of Jacob Morand's Kaddish. Hi, Jacob. Thank you for joining me. Where am I finding you?
Right now, I'm in my studio in Sweden.
We're speaking because I just heard your new release, Kaddish, which is on the album Time that you're releasing next week in time for International Holocaust Day. Now, I was just completely floored, blown away, really. I haven't heard contemporary classical music that I've liked in a long time, for one thing, but it was so moving. Can you please tell me a little bit about the backstory of this piece?
First of all, thank you so much for your kind words. And yes, I mean, it's a highly personal and emotional piece. So it's all about my family and my background. So my grandfather was a survivor from the Holocaust. And he survived both Auschwitz and Bergen-Belsen. And so in this piece, I'm asking the questions that I never had the chance to ask. Since I was an infant when he was alive, I wasn't able to ask those very important questions that I think we all, the humanity can learn from. So the questions of what his experience was, what he survived. I wanted to know that. And in this piece, I'm asking those questions that I never had the chance to ask. And the answers is actually a documentation that my father did with my grandfather. My father interviewed my grandfather about his experience and how he survived. And from those answers, I simulated an imaginary dialogue between me and my grandfather, the one we never had. And so that is my starting point when I begin to compose the piece. But the piece actually starts with a quote from the author Elie Wiesel about that for the dead and for the living, we must bear witness. And I think that's the whole point for me. That's the message of the piece, that we need to bear witness so we can be sure that this can never happen again.
Let's talk about the piece itself in terms of its musicality. It begins, it sounded to me like a rumble of perhaps train tracks. I don't know if I'm reading too much into it, but it felt like a gradual build at the very beginning. What were you thinking in this?
I mean, I think for me it's very... I imagine that people can hear all sorts of things in this beginning, because it's very open and it's very, contemplative or meditative. So I think it's a story that wants to break out from this sound. I think this sound, I mean, within the Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism, the melodies without words has a higher spiritual value. So for me, the beginning and a lot of parts in the Kaddish, for me it's like the grief that you can't really put into words.
To remind our listeners, the Kaddish is the Jewish prayer for mourning. Now, it's orchestrated with a full orchestra. Tell us a little bit about this, but there's also a full choir, correct?
It's actually a cappella choir. So, it sounds like instrumental, but it's actually just the human voices.
I'm actually blown away. I can't fathom that right now. Actually, it sounded so clearly to me like an orchestra. That just shows how distracted perhaps I was when listening to it. But it's just, as they say, a wall of sound at a certain point.
Yeah, I mean, that is one of my... I wanted to build up this wall that, the choir is a very collective instrument. I mean, the whole choir, it only gets effect when everyone is synchronizing and singing together. And I think that's the same to make a witness. When we do it together, when people come together to witness together, then it really does get that effect.
It clearly gives that effect. It's just so moving. I was trying to work when I was listening to it and I just couldn't. I had to stop everything and just listen. Just beautiful, really beautiful. Now, much of your music is actually influenced by your Judaism, is it not?
Yeah, it really is. Liturgical Jewish music is one of my absolutely most important sources of inspiration.
And even your earlier compositions have Hebrew names for them. Can you give us some examples?
Yeah, I mean, for example, I actually wrote a piece called Amidah, which is the most holy prayer. And also I wrote another choir piece, which is also on the album called Nigun. And I really love the... Also, I have a quite special also relation to the Hebrew language, because I think it's so beautiful, but since I can't understand every word, I really love to use it as a palette of colors for the choir, for example, because it has the language itself has so many beautiful sounds. So I sometimes feel like a visual artist painting with the color of the beautiful language of Hebrew, which I really like.
The texture of ch is hard to get across, perhaps, in a choir.
I love that. And that's the different sounds are so interesting.
For sure. Now, you're recorded on Deutsche Grammophon, which is arguably the leading classical music label in the world. How did that come about, and what was your feeling when you learned of it?
A guy from the Universal company that actually was at the world premiere of, I think, at least two of my choir pieces. And one day he actually came to me after the premiere and said, "I want to record this." And then we actually we flew to Berlin from Stockholm and had the meeting with Deutsche Grammophon. And I don't know how it happened actually. Then suddenly we we had this huge project going on, and I have to say, I mean, to have this amazing choir as the Swedish Radio Choir, I mean, it's like one of the best choirs in the world, I would say. I think it's among, yeah, like the fifth best. And I mean, to have these amazing singers and to work with this amazing label like Deutsche Grammophon, I mean, then everything seemed possible. So we actually recorded this within, I think we did it within a month or two. So it was a huge project, like full time and with all the 32 singers in from the choir. So it was a really, yeah, it was an amazing project. And it was a lot of people involved. And I think the result is very, for me, it's very touching and very emotional. And I'm very thankful for all the people who has giving me this opportunity.
I assume all of the recording was done prior to the coronavirus pandemic?
Yeah, exactly. It was done, before.
Even though you're in Sweden, and as is somewhat, I suppose, notorious, Sweden has a different take on. Has the coronavirus pandemic affected your work in any way?
Yeah, I mean, of course, there are some premieres that are postponed. But since like the time from when I get a commission on a piece, for example, now I'm working for the Stockholm Royal Philharmonics on an big orchestra piece. It takes me like a year or one year and a half to write the music. So in that case, I mean, to postpone a thing 1 year, that doesn't affect me that much. But I feel it really breaks my heart when I see like very good musicians that are out of work, and when I see like institutions like operas and concert halls being empty, it feels very sorrowful for me. It's a catastrophe. I mean, of course.
Yes, yeah. I think we didn't even mention how old you are. How old are you?
Yeah, I'm 29.
Which is just phenomenal, really seeing your body of work and just how beautifully you're writing it at this age. I look forward to so much more in the future, and really such a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you. The same to you. Same to you.
Hi, it's Sarah Tuttle Singer from The Times of Israel. Come join our community and support fast and fair independent journalism. You can sign up with the link at the bottom of every single article on the site.
Now we'll hear from Katharina van Schnorbein, who speaks about the incremental changes throughout the European Union since she took the post of European Commission Coordinator on Combating Antisemitism 5 years ago. Katharina, thank you so much for joining me. Where am I finding you?
Hi, it's a pleasure to be with you. I'm in Brussels, Belgium, and that is where the European Commission is located.
And what do you do with the European Commission?
I've been the European Commission Coordinator on Combating Antisemitism since December 2015. I've been working on this topic intensively with the Jewish communities and, of course, with the institutions on the European level and the member states and all the different actors involved.
And how did you come to this position? You're not Jewish yourself. So what brought you to the fight against the oldest hatred against Jews?
I think there are probably different motives. One is that personally, I'm German, and this has always been an issue, let's say, in our family. We've discussed such matters, and my parents have instilled on us the responsibility we have. But then also I was the advisor to the president of the European Commission on the dialogue with religions. So in that context, I had already quite a bit of contacts with the Jewish communities, in particular the religious ones, but also beyond. And then I think I was just also at the right place in the right moment when the commission was looking for somebody. I said I would be interested in December 2015. So, and I have to say, I haven't regretted a bit. It's really been it's really been rewarding, interesting. I've learned so much also myself about the Jewish culture and traditions and Jewish life. Also, the struggles, of course, and the challenges that the Jewish communities face every day in Europe.
What are some of the challenges facing the Jewish communities in Europe right now in terms of anti-Semitism?
Well, there is a wide range. And I think there's also different challenges in Eastern Europe and Western Europe. When we look to Western Europe, the challenge really is that there are security threats that are felt, in particular by religious members of the Jewish community that can be recognized as Jewish, but also beyond. And I think these you know physical threats have led to a situation where you have very high security needs that are simply burdensome in everyday life, but also in more general terms. You know, the poisoning, let's say, of the environment by asking questions such as questioning Jewish loyalty to the country, questioning also, you know, where the community is in terms of their activities and so on. This is a real challenge. In Eastern Europe, I think it's there we see a very deeply rooted anti-Semitism as well. It is different because the communities are very small often, with the exception of Hungary, where we have the largest Jewish community in Eastern Europe, where also Jewish life really thrives and is visible. But I think this has led to a lot of conspiracy myths about Jews because people don't know a lot of Jews there. So, you know, all of this is, I think we have to look at all of these aspects and we have to look at all forms of anti-Semitism, whether it comes from the left or from the right, from within the Islamist circles and really address all these aspects separately. And to do that, we have developed different instruments.
Just last week, your organization helped publicize the IHRA handbook for the practical use in defining anti-Semitism. And I put the emphasis on practical. Can you tell us a little bit about this handbook?
Yes. Yeah, so we found in the discussions with the member states that have adopted the IHRA definition as a non-legally binding tool, that they had questions on how they could actually apply this. For those who don't know, the IHRA definition is a definition that was adopted by the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, so IHRA, as a tool for their own work with regards to addressing anti-Semitism.
Because part of the definition is slightly counterintuitive even. It could encompass many different aspects that perhaps most people don't even consider when speaking about anti-Semitism. What is the definition loosely?
So the idea really is to help people recognize the different forms of contemporary anti-Semitism that we see today. Because I think there's one specificity about anti-Semitism. It developed over time, but it never got rid of old forms of anti-Semitism. Let's say, you know, the racist forms that we saw and that led up to the Shoah have not gone away, unfortunately. While after the Shoah, we added new forms of, for example, Holocaust denial and distortion and Israel-related anti-Semitism. So it's important to recognize all of them. And that's really the idea of the IHRA definition.
Especially the line about Israel is so difficult to wrap your head around, I think, for many people, including myself in a certain way, because if you listen to the rhetoric in Israel, when we're talking about our own country and our own prime minister, et cetera, you would think that every Israeli or half the country is anti-Semitic. And, you know, to be honest, possibly slightly. But how can you pinpoint this particular aspect of it a little bit more? The anti-Israel equals anti-Semitism.
Well, in not all forms, equal anti-Semitism. I think this is a very important aspect, and it clearly says that criticism of Israel, like that leveled at any other country, cannot be considered as anti-Semitic. I think this is an important first aspect. However, then when there are double standards, when Israel is held responsible in other ways than other countries would, that is, for example, one form. It also always depends on the context. But then really it is about addressing anti-Semitism in a context where Jews are not the majority. And there, to hold Jews responsible for the actions of the government of Israel is unacceptable. It is it clearly shows that that you project on the Jews in your country something with which they are not connected, because they're not necessarily Israeli citizens. And even if they were, you know, it's not that you hold the citizen responsible necessarily for the government. So I think all of these aspects are, this is important to recognize.
You've been in your role now for 5 years. What broad strokes changes have you seen in the past 5-6 years almost? And is there any improvement at all over this period of time?
No, I think there are two aspects. If we look at anti-Semitism as such, and whether, you know, it was, the changes have been felt by the Jewish communities, I think we have to be honest, not much has improved yet. It takes time for policy decisions to take effect and to actually trickle down. I believe that with regards to the reassurance of the Jewish community that on European level, but also on national levels, this issue of anti-Semitism is taken seriously, this has certainly improved. And I also see that there has been a lot of improvement in terms of the policies. So we had a declaration against anti-Semitism by unanimity of all member states in 2018, where they, among other, agreed to adopt this definition, but also to ensure the security of Jewish communities and to ensure education, to ensure remembrance. So all of these aspects have been covered by this declaration. Now, in December, under the German EU presidency, we had another declaration, again adopted by unanimity of the member states, where they say the fight against anti-Semitism must be so-called mainstreamed across all policy areas. So in all the relevant policy areas that can have an effect on the way Jews are viewed or create anti-Semitic ideas, we have to see how we can counter them in the different policy areas. So this is another important step to say, you know, it's not, anti-Semitism is not something that exists in a silo, but it is really, it needs to be addressed in education, in training, in law enforcement, in the, we need better data collection also of incidents to make it visible. And that is maybe one aspect, because we are succeeding in better recording of incidents, also in better notification by victims, because the underreporting used to be really high. But now we see that Jewish communities have more trust in authorities, or they go to specific organizations that are being created to support victims, that you know, the numbers of incidents are going up, but I don't know whether they were lower before or whether simply we know now more about them. And that is in itself a positive thing, because then it can also be better addressed.
It sounds like through your work and the work of your organization, the Jews of Europe now feel more seen and more comfortable in expressing any kind of prejudice that they're feeling in a day-to-day basis.
Well, you should ask them, but I would hope so.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you joining me.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening to Times Will Tell, and a special thanks to TLV1 Studios for sound production help. If you like what you hear, please subscribe to Times Will Tell on all podcast platforms. Now, please stay tuned for Jacob Boran's Kaddish from the Deutsche Grammophon recording, Time.